Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Welcome back to another exciting edition of the Pointless Exercise Podcast. I'm joined today by old friend Andrew Lawrence, who is a writer for The Guardian, amongst other places.
Hi.
How are you doing, Drew?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm great. So we're going to talk about some stuff, but we're specifically going to talk about the Bears and what they're going to do with their number one pick, and I'm sure they won't screw it up. We're going to talk a little bit about what the hell's going on with the Bulls, but I want to spend some time talking to you because you are an F1 expert, and I am a.
I've been called that.
I'm in like year 2.5 of being an F1 fan, and I know it all. So you're gonna confirm. to me that I completely understand everything about it.
Awesome.
But first off, thanks to some final Sunday of the season shenanigans by the Bears' old friend Lovie Smith. The Texans pissed Lovie off so much that he coached his final game in the most un-Lovie-like fashion, and that aggressiveness led the Texans to an improbable win, and the Bears now sit there with the number one pick in the draft. And first of all, do you buy any of the... I guess Ryan Poles tamped it down quite a bit on the first day of the combine, but do you buy any of the, ooh, the Bears might trade Justin Fields and keep the pick talk?
I don't know what to think. It just feels like, you know, like when like people win the lottery and like you think their life is going to be great and it turns out it like it becomes nothing but like heartache and suffering and like somebody kills them or they like die in some mysterious or like this is what it feels like for the Bears to have the number one draft pick. It's just like How are they not just like how are they going to mess it up, but like how calamitous is it going to be when they mess it up? Just because, like, you know, like this team is not like it's not run in such a way where you're like, okay, you know, like somebody like, you know, like the organization like the Rams or the Patriots, you know, like Atlanta, like the team, even Atlanta, star-crossed Atlanta, I would expect to like know how to manage the situation. But you know, this is like way too much pressure for the Bears, and I just feel like they're gonna throw up all over themselves, and it's gonna be hugely embarrassing.
Just imagine.
But to answer your question.
I was going to say, just imagine if the Falcons had the number one pick, you know, because Ryan Pace and Phil Emery both work for them.
Yeah.
Can you imagine Ryan Pace sitting in the thing going, all right, we have the number one pick. How many picks can we give up to move up?
That's true. I'm just saying, like, in general, throughout the course of, like, historically, throughout the course of that organization, like, the organization sort of runs itself in a way where you feel like they would know how to leverage an asset that. And I mean, feel like the Bears have no clue.
No, the Bears have been run by the same family of goobers for 103 years. And it really went off the rails when the guy who basically invented professional football died. And they've been cast adrift ever since with his, with the wrong side of his family running it. Because his son was supposed to run it, and Muggs died on him and didn't have any kids. And so the McCaskies have grabbed onto it with both hands, and you're right. And they haven't had the number one pick since the 40s. They had it twice, and one of them they took Mark Harmon's dad.
Oh, wow, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, Tom Harmon.
Was he a good actor?
He wasn't a very good, and he was a good college player. He was not a very good professional football player, as the Bears found out.
Yeah.
I have been optimistic. I've taken the thought that Ryan Poles. And you can't convince me that the Bears didn't just swap out one Matt and Ryan for another Matt and Ryan just to save on the painting on the windows.
Stationery. Business cards.
That the whole talk was, all right, we need people to think that all options are on the table when they want to come talk to us about a trade. Yeah. And so we're not just going to blindly go, we feel like we have our quarterback. We don't need to take a quarterback with the first pick. But then at the Combine press conference, Poles basically said, no one has called and made him an offer for Justin Fields. So we haven't had to worry about thinking about it. When the first day of the Combine, Adam Schefter immediately tweets out, like as business is, like literally as that Starbucks in the lobby is opening, tweets out that the Bears are open for business and they're leaning towards trading the pick. People are like, oh God, they must not have gotten any calls. Mike Lombardi actually said that. That's a panic. You contact an NFL writer because no one has contacted you. I find that hard to believe because I would think there's teams check in just in case, right? I took it more as we found out when he talked at the press conference, he'd really like to trade that pick sooner rather than later. And I think that basically him telling Schefter, go ahead, you know, put this out, was typically teams don't trade this pick till early April. We're open to trading it next week. So let's as a team out there who hasn't contacted us yet, you might not have time. That's how I took it.
Interesting. I take it as, even though obviously you're under new management, but like, the Trubisky effect. They have the first pick, but don't worry, they'll pick the wrong player. So nobody, you know, like, it's like, you know, a musical chairs. Everybody just stay seated and just let the Bears get up. And then somebody take their seat. Like, it's fine. We don't have to do anything.
So you don't believe they're going to pull off the rare double trade down where They're gonna trade with the Texans at 2, and then they're gonna trade with the Colts at 4, and they're just gonna sit there with this huge pile of draft picks, and it's gonna be like the 83 draft, and they're gonna sign all these future Hall of Famers and stars on their next Super Bowl championship team. You're not that optimistic that's gonna happen.
I would love to believe that, but they have never, barred that one moment in time. In recent history, haven't really been visionary about team building. Like, apart from like, you know, we want a strong defense and we want a great running back. And I just feel like it's only like in the last 10 years that they have joined like the modern offensive revolution. And I just feel like Hurts and Jackson have shown you enough to believe that that Fields' ceiling, it might even be higher than you think it is.
Yeah.
And that, like, that their real priority should be like, okay, how do we basically Philly made Justin Fields, or Philly made Hurts great by just putting all kinds of weapons around him so that like he couldn't fail. Like, even if he was like a little bit off, AJ Brown would cop with, like, he was, AJ Brown's catch radius is so big that he couldn't possibly miss him if he tried. Like, that should be their strategy. And if they land the number one pick, they should be like, okay, Fields is our guy, and like, we have a guy that we can work with. So it's just about like getting him the arsenal to bring out the potential. But the fact that they're just like, well, nobody's made us an offer yet, it just shows like, okay, you guys have no plan. There's no plan here.
I mean, this is a franchise that has never had a 4,000-yard passer, ever. Not a single season. Eric Kramer came close once. Jay would have done it 1 year, and he hurt something with, like, 3 weeks to go. Their leading all-time receiver is Johnny Morris, who was a flanker, not even a wide receiver.
Yeah.
Hasn't played in 50 years, more than 50 years, and has barely 5,000 career receiving yards. I mean, this is a
Moose didn't get
Remember This Crap, Mike Donahue and I talk about this all the time because it's just the most fascinating thing for us is just how consistently awful the Bears passing game has been forever. It's like, that's a bigger tradition for the Bears than Hall of Fame middle linebackers is inept passing. I mean, they never have a year without that. They don't always have a Hall of Fame middle linebacker, but they never have a competent passing game.
And it's just like, that's an area where they can get good right away, where it's not just like, they already have a good tight end, so why not just go shopping in the SEC for some receivers? Like, clearly, that will return investment immediately, you know?
Well, they did draft an SEC receiver last year.
That is true. That is true. But now,
Phillips Jones.
I know, right? even when we have the opportunity, we find what's the oldest prospect in this draft that we can I feel like Fields, not only does Fields have the talent to improve, he has the chip on his shoulder. He's looking at Trevor Lawrence being like, that should have been me, he's getting better. Like, I've been better than that guy pretty much my entire life. It's a travesty that I fell as far in the draft as I did. And like, he's hungry. So like, feed him, you know? So I just, it's so frustrating. And then they're going to move to Arlington Heights anyway. So then at that point, I'll really have to like, reconsider, my fandom. But yeah, all this talk of like playing indoors, like you're still gonna play like bare weather ball inside.
Oh, they're still gonna somehow make sure they just have terrible grass indoor. No, we're gonna grow grass in here. You can't. And we're gonna do it anyway.
We're gonna do it anyway.
It won't be any worse than the crap we were playing
on
Soldier Field.
Four concerts a week and mess it up.
We got a high school triple header on Friday.
Yeah.
Right. Saturday, College of DuPage is going to play here. And then now we'll play on Sunday. It'll be great.
God.
It's
exasperating.
For people
clearly.
Who are like, well, there are a few national football supposed experts who I get the feeling, like Mike Tannenbaum on ESPN, every day. Yeah. Every day makes the case on that stupid Get Up show about how the Bears should trade Justin Fields. And the two reasons he gives that they should do this is, number one, then they would restart they'd have a quarterback on a rookie contract, but they'd go back 2 years, and that's a real value.
The Bears have
almost $100 million in cap space. This is not a team that needs to worry about 3 years from now having to pay big money to their quarterback. That argument holds nothing with me.
To anybody.
The other part of it is he's so enamored with Bryce Young and thinks he's going to be a superstar. So I'm going to ask you a trivia question here. Bryce Young, we'll find out. I don't know if he weighed in today at the combine or not, but he's listed at Alabama at like 192 pounds, which means he probably weighs 175.
Yeah.
Do you know the last?
He's like barely 6 foot.
Yeah. Do you know the last quarterback to be drafted in the first round who weighed less than 200 pounds?
Is it, what's his name in Arizona?
No, Kyler Murray weighed more than 200
Murray?
Pounds.
I don't know.
It's Jim McMahon.
Really?
That's how far you have to go back. And he was like 196 pounds or something.
Great guy. Terrible, terrible health comp.
Well, and see, wouldn't that scare you then? You're like, all right.
Yes.
What was the only thing that derailed Jim McMahon? He could never stay healthy. If you hit him, he would throw his body around like he was durable, but he wasn't. So he would always be hurt. The thing about Bryce Young is there have been short quarterbacks, even in recent years, who've been really good. Like Drew Brees is not tall.
Yeah.
But Drew Brees is not small. He was short.
Right.
He was sturdy. He was,
Russell was another guy.
Right, Russell Wilson.
Was shorter.
Probably not even 6 foot, but he's thick. Kyler at 5'2", or whatever he is, looks like a little ball running around because he's got muscles on him.
Yeah.
It's not just that Bryce is short. Bryce is small. He doesn't have a frame that it looks like you could put a lot of weight on. And he's really good, but how much good is that going to do you when a 340-pound guy plops on him and your really talented quarterback now has broken like 4 bones and you're going to see him again next year? That's, this discussion would be a real discussion if the Bears had
as opposed to the quarterback that you have who is gigantic and people bounce off of him and he can take off for like a 95-yard touchdown run at any point.
Yeah, you'd be trading in slightly better accuracy for a waif, basically.
Yeah.
Like, if you're going to make a pros and cons list for Justin Fields, the pros, there are a lot.
Yeah.
The cons are real, but they're overcomable. He is, the thing about him being slow to react to defense is true. We see it. We see it all the time. And he's surprisingly, for as accurate as he is down the field, he's a tremendously accurate deep thrower and a good, he misses a lot of short throws. And part of that is because he, for some reason, will just decide, kind of Brett Favre-esque, I think I'm just going to sidearm this one.
Yeah.
It's like, Justin, you're 6'3", throw it over the guy. Don't bounce it off the face of a lineman. But all the other stuff he's got, that's a pretty short list of cons. And it's one that, two of them I think are related. I think the inaccuracy on the short throws and the variable mechanics, I think that's one issue. I don't think it's two.
It's so and you fixable, put him, though.
Right. It's completely fixable. So is the, because I think we've already seen it. I think we saw during his first full year as a starter and his first full year without Matt Nagy around being dumb. It looked like he was processing defenses faster. So it could be a year from now. There's barely anything on the cons list. So why would you change now? I don't see it. And to the Bears' credit, I don't think they've actually given any serious thought to changing quarterbacks. I think it's just a frustrating, the Bears have the number one pick, and what's the most obvious storyline we could talk about to fill 15 minutes on whatever chat show we've got? Well, let's talk about the Bears screwing it up and trading the first really good quarterback they've had in a long time.
Yeah. Who gives me Josh Allen vibes, frankly. I think Fields could be really, really good. And the whole difference for Josh Allen was coaching and talent.
Yeah.
And he became Josh Allen. Yeah.
Well, John Greenberg and I were talking about how I think people don't realize how big Justin is. And I think the reason, and John gave the reason, he's got a baby face. So like on TV, you think, oh, he's obviously a sturdy looking dude, but you don't realize that he's almost 6'4", and he's like 235 pounds, and he's usually the fastest guy on the field. And
Which we never got to see really at Ohio State because he was just lighting it up with his arm.
Yeah, he had. And part of the reason I'm sure that he was that he's a little slow sometimes on reads is he had like 12 seconds to throw at Ohio State.
Yeah,
you could wait for the fourth option to get all the way across the field. It's like, oh, he's going to get open eventually. I'll just wait. And then you exacerbate that by giving him you give him the Bears receivers. And the Bears offensive line. And all of a sudden it's like, holy crap, I don't have any time to do anything.
Yeah, it's just like...
So hopefully they'll fix it.
He has two or three... so what I'm hearing is two or three deficiencies that are fixable for a guy who has talent, physical, the right sort of physical stature and tools, high work ethic, and a grudge and an axe to grind against the league. Like, if that doesn't scream like future superstar, like we need to hang on to this guy with our fingernails, like I don't know what does.
Yeah, I agree. So I know Chris Ballard poo-pooed it during his little media session, but it seems to me like the most obvious trade that the Bears will get offered and they'll probably take is trading down to 4.
Yeah.
So the Colts can move up to 1 and get their quarterback, especially since crazy Jim Irsay basically said, even before he hired his new coach, well, that kid from Alabama looks pretty good.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jim. Just could you not just go sing somewhere? We don't need you talking.
You and Jim Dolan have a gig somewhere?
Oh, God, I hope.
Yeah.
People pay big money for that. It's too bad Ed McCaskey's not still around. He was like a lounge singer. That was
Was he really?
Virginia. Oh yeah. George never liked him. and he would sing Bear Down Chicago Bears at the drop of a hat for anybody, anytime. That's great.
Yeah.
So everybody's been talking about, well, the Bears need to make it. If the Bears somehow stay in the top four, which they probably should, they're going to have to pick between Jalen Carter, Georgia, and Will Anderson at Alabama. And then Jalen was supposed to talk to media at the combine on Wednesday, and then he didn't. And then they found out that the accident, quote-unquote accident, that killed the Georgia player sometime in January, that guy was racing, and the guy he was racing was Jalen Carter.
And the sports information intern. I don't want her to get forgotten in this tragedy either. But yeah, I was shocked to learn that. And it's just like, this is why I'm like, all right, so there goes Plan B. What else you got? What else you got, guys? Anything else? Can we interest you in any other positions on the board?
This is funny because that position, which back I'm old enough to remember when they called that a defensive tackle, but now it's a 3 technique.
Yeah,
is like the linchpin to the Matt Eberflus defense.
Yeah.
So like that's like the perfect guy for them to take, and now there's a big question mark hanging over it. Although, somebody on Yahoo wrote a thing about it this morning about asked some personnel guys, how will this affect his draft stock? And they all basically went, it won't.
Yeah, that's true.
It's two misdemeanors. They'll plead to something. By the time the draft comes,
it'll be old news.
Which is kind of sad. But...
super sad. And the fact that, unlike quarterback, we love defensive stars in Chicago. So, if he's productive right away, it'll be water under the bridge immediately.
Yeah, people will. They'll talk about it. It'll be one of those things that he has to talk about at rookie camp.
Yeah.
And then maybe again at the first day of training camp. And then
it'll be over.
It'll be on to other stuff. Like, why aren't you, why didn't you have 4 sacks on Sunday?
Right.
Other local team.
Or how are you adjusting to all the double teams you're getting, or something like that? Yeah.
So the other local team I want to talk to you about are the Bulls, who knew Lonzo Ball was the key to the entire Arturas Karnišovas rebuild, but it was. He's been out more than a year now. He's not going to come back this season at all. His career is in serious jeopardy. And it's literally true that the last time they were good was the last game he played in. He really did kind of make all of the other pieces fit. And now he's not there. But don't worry about it. They have replaced him with Patrick Beverley. So now everything's fine.
Where to even start here? I remember writing last year at the break when they had the league's best record, like, hey man, you know, hope is finally through the worst of it, and maybe this squad will sort of bridge the last dance and the next dance, you know, like this is good. This is, you know, like we're moving on. And now I'm just like, how is the medical team with the Bulls not just been totally sacked at this point? Because, like, between Lonzo and Dragic and Caruso and just, like, everybody, it just seems like nobody gets better. The injuries just get more. In a way, it's kind of a miracle that LaVine is playing, because he came in with the most problems of anybody. Yeah. But I'm just like, you know, what happens? and is there are there whispers about this? You know, is this a thing that keeps other players from signing here? It's so frustrating, because, you know, I went and saw them this year against they played here in Atlanta. It was the double overtime game, that I was just like, you know, the whole time, DeRozan was fabulous, but the whole time you're just like, they shouldn't be in this game. They should not be in this game. They should be blown out. This thing should have been like a 25-point blowout. But yet they're like hanging around, and you're just like, they have talent, and it just like none of, and you're right, like none of the pieces fit because their whole point guard picture is messed up.
Yeah, they have talent. They are relatively deep. They have a good coach. Yeah. And
I really like Donovan as a coach, but then it just seems like the team is totally checked out on him now, and Vooch is like so frustrating to watch, because it's like so big, and it's like, at what point? It was cool when you didn't rebound when you were like scoring 18 points a game, but now that you're scoring like 11, it's like, Do something to assert yourself in this game. Oh, it's like, it makes it hard to, as a Bulls fan who became an NBA fan, as a Bulls fan, to really invest in the NBA when the home team is so terrible. And I was there, and now I'm like, you know, falling back a little bit.
It's to the point, it doesn't feel like the Jordan era Bulls were the same franchise. Not even the same team. Did that happen?
I lived through
it. I saw it. I watched every game. I enjoyed the hell out of it. And here we are now, I can't do math, like 25 years later. And 27 years later. No, 25. And you're like,
every year we get past that era is like, just validates how incredibly good a general manager Jerry Krause was. Just to like keep all of that together, not just to keep all of that together amidst the dysfunction on the roster. You know, now like the two best players apparently hated each other the entire time, and now it's just like all out there. And obviously, like, he didn't get along with coach. But then to like always add the right piece to keep the thing going, it's just, you know, like, we can't even get like the corner piece of the puzzle right. And yet, like, he's just like, ah, well, you know, we're missing, you know, like, this shooter drops off, I'll just get some more shooters from here, and you know, this power forward from here, and like, we'll just, you know, as long as I can like convince Jordan and Scotty to hang around, like, we can keep this thing rolling, you know. I'll bring in this guy from Croatia. They'll hate him for a little bit, but then they'll see that like he can actually be useful, like really, really useful, and like, but, and they'll hang around and they'll win some more championships together. It's, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's,
he'd be great on Get Up, by the way.
Krause. Jerry Krause. Yeah, I mean, he was so weird that was part, yeah, of the, you know, the weird secret stuff. Like, do you remember the story about him trying to sneak Will Perdue in for a draft, for a pre-draft visit, as if people found out that the Bulls were talking about drafting the exciting Will Perdue, that was somehow going to, yeah, screw up the whole draft. It's like, Jerry, just knock it off.
Just picture him riding in a car up the skyway with like a giant black blanket or something, a sheet over this like 7-foot man. Yeah, people can't know that you're here, Will. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so it's either that Jerry was a great general manager and figured out, would find even some of the unorthodox moves, like getting Bill Cartwright. You know, yeah. He traded Charles Oakley, who was Michael's best friend at the time and was like the enforcer and a productive, yeah, rebounder, trading him for this odd bodied, you know, his ass was up right, you know, under his neck almost, yeah, with a ridiculous free throw motion that he had.
With that ridiculous the pendulum shooting motion that he had.
Traded for him, and it
but was like, this is the only guy in the East who can defend, yeah, Patrick Ewing, so we need him.
Yeah. It's either that he figured that out completely, or it's just that Jordan was so good that,
yeah. Well, he, also
all of a sudden, Bobby Hanson seems like a, yeah, really good idea. That was perfect. That's, yeah, just what we need. He's going to make three threes off the bench in Game 6 of the final, but this ridiculous comeback against the Blazers at home, and it'll all be, yeah, keyed by Bobby Hanson. So it was a little bit of both. Yeah, I mean, the sad thing about the current iteration of the Bulls is that in order to get the players they currently have, you know, they don't have very much draft capital left.
They gave up a lot.
The guys are all older, so even at the trade deadline, it's not like they could start flipping them to get picks back. People are like, well, yeah, we'd like him, but we're not giving you a first-rounder for it. Certainly not an unprotected first-rounder for it.
Yeah.
Had they bottomed out this year in a draft where everybody wants to get, you know, Victor Wembanyama, their lottery pick, well, I guess that's the one guy they could have gotten, because they lose the pick to the Magic unless it's top four, which it's not going to be,
yeah,
which is why they're trying to get in the play-in tournament, because it's like, we're going to lose our draft pick. We might as well go, might as well get semi into the kind of playoffs.
Yeah.
And then last year they had this, when they were good, they had this team that could just, any bad team they could obliterate, and they couldn't beat any of the good teams. And this year it's the opposite. Yeah. Like, they have no problem with the Celtics. They beat the Bucks a couple of times. They have a great record against, yeah, the best teams, and then they will get beat by anybody else. Just,
yeah,
or they'll blow a huge lead to do it. It's exasperating.
Although they did have their moment against the Nets after the Nets fire sale, where they, yeah, blew the doors off of them. Yeah.
They had
which must have felt nice.
They
but
had a
50-point
lead at one point in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, wait a minute, 50?
Which is the team that I thought they were going to be in the first half of last season, when they were just steamrolling over everybody, and you know, and fared pretty well against like the Nets. I think they struggled with the Celtics, but the Nets, it seemed like they always did. They they matched up pretty well against them. I could have that wrong, but
I think for some reason
I think that. But yeah, I'm just like, I don't know. So basically how I'm coping is I wrote about the Grizzlies this week because Ja Morant reminds me so much of Derrick Rose, down to the questionable the dubious entourage.
Yep.
The
occasional that I'm just spills like, out onto the court.
Right? That I'm like, oh man, I hope maybe Memphis will find a way not to mess this up, because like get the same level of excitement watching him, except it seems like he's a little bit better at like protecting his body and when he like flings it into traffic than Rose was.
It'd be hard to be worse than Derek, because he almost didn't even bother to break his fall. Just yeah. Like, oh, that's what the ground is for. It's like, no, yeah. Derek, it's yeah. not. You can brace yeah. yourself. You don't have to just smack the court as hard as you possibly can every yeah. time you get hit.
There's metal behind that stanchion cushion. Like, that's not like a comfy, that's not a couch cushion.
It's like, Derek, they don't put the ice under the court for you to like ice down your body while you're laying on the floor. That's for hockey later.
Yeah.
You're gonna want to you're gonna want to stick your arm out and catch yourself.
But yeah, it's just another Chicago team that I'm just like, what's going on there? Man, you're supposed to be the well-run organization that makes sense, and this is happening to you. So now it's just like, who do we look to for a glimmer of hope? The Sky lost Candace Parker. I mean, it's all falling apart.
Yeah, the Sky's.
Sky's.
They basically had a. They didn't even have a fire sale. Everybody just left.
Yeah.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
All right, so I'm one of those annoying people who, over the pandemic, when I had nothing to do, I was flipping around Netflix, and I started watching. I'd heard all this stuff about it. I'm like, I'm not going to watch three seasons of this docuseries about European race car drivers. I'm like, I'm not going to watch this. And I started to watch it.
Yeah, you are.
And it's like, it's so good. It's...
Yeah.
So Formula really One, good. I mean, they're the best drivers in the world.
Yeah.
And it's... The key to this whole thing is how easy it is to, like, learn the cast of characters. There's only 10 teams. There's only 20 drivers. And then there's these crazy, weird CEO sort of guys, the principals, who most of them have these outsized personalities. It makes for super compelling television. So as you start to watch it, all of a sudden you know things about the drivers. There's drivers you immediately like. There's drivers you immediately... Actually, you kind of almost like all of them. There's a few... Where you're like, that guy seems like a prick.
Yeah.
I guarantee you I couldn't spend 40 seconds in a room with Pierre Gasly. I just couldn't.
He's a guy I really love. Yeah.
You can stay with him. To me, he's just the epitome of whiny French person.
Well, Pierre got a bad break, you know. But he should be out of the sport, but he has proved that he belonged, even though he had a very, very hard hazing as Max Verstappen's Red Bull teammate.
Yeah, that's one of the themes of the early seasons is who is Red Bull running out of their number two spot to replace with somebody else?
Just grinding them down,
So
they're working on Checo now, who is the best teammate as Max has ever had.
I love Checo Perez. He seems like the coolest guy. So it's funny watching the early episodes, and uh, you you go to the pastoral home in the English countryside of Red Bull principal Christian Horner, and he's got this cute redheaded wife, and I'm like, oh, she looks like Ginger Spice. And then you find out 30 seconds later, it is Ginger Spice.
Absolutely.
That's who these people, this is the kind of money these people have, where when there's this failed race car driver who is now running Red Bull Racing, it just ends up with a Spice Girl as his wife. And it's completely normal. After a while, it doesn't even phase you that that's the kind of people that you're going to see in this thing.
They feed the livestock, pet the horses, she gives him a kiss. And then he gets in a helicopter and goes to work just like anybody
just
else.
Just like you and me.
Just like any other regular guy, you know?
So the first season of Drive to Survive, you spent a lot of time with Red Bull because Ferrari and Mercedes didn't want anything to do with it. It was either going to be a waste of time or they were going to give away, Netflix was going to give away their trade secrets and they didn't want it. So the best driver in the history of F1, Lewis Hamilton, he's in the documentary only driving his car on the racetrack. It's the only time you ever hear from him. It's the only time you ever see him. And they course
arguably, and in addition to being the best driver, it's arguably the most interesting personality driving because of his incredibly varied interests and the fact that he is like actually engaged with the wider world that we live in.
Right, which as you get to know the drivers, you realize most of them aren't.
They just know the car, and they just know the races, and that's it.
They seem to spend all their time either in their race car or doing weird resistance band training with their physio. Because they all have like a personal trainer who spends more time with them than anybody else in the world. That's the person that they're always hanging out with. So, yeah, I'm glad that Pierre Gasly is not as big a prick as I thought he was.
He's a really sweet guy. Yeah.
So the current two-time reigning world champion, Max Verstappen.
Yes.
Is a great driver. He's a very awkward person. You can tell he's a guy who has always been really good at this. His dad, Jost, was that his name?
Jost.
Was also a driver who we learned in this season. Used to hang out all the time with Michael Schumacher. So,
yes.
Max and Mick Schumacher, they spent a lot of time together. It didn't look like they were friends. Max to me seems like a guy who's not had a lot of friends. His friend is his car. That's Max's path.
His car, his girlfriend, his in-laws, just a dubious collection of folks. Yeah.
Yes, his girlfriend, whose father, Red Bull had to like tell him to not come around the track last year because he said horrible racist things.
A lot of that.
You can stay in Brazil for a while. That would be fine.
A lot of that kicking around the sport, unfortunately. My son just walked in. He's playing with an Elmo doll, listener. So
we've had
going on in my neck of the
woods. We've had worse on this podcast than somebody.
Okay, good.
Tickle
good.
Me Elmo. Yeah. So Max to me is I like watching him drive, but I really enjoy the awkward interactions after races, because one of the things is there's all this stage stuff that has to happen after a race. If you finish on the podium, first, second, or third, first thing you have to do is you have to drive your car up and park behind the right little sign, because they have a 1-2-3 set up on the track. Then you have to go into the cool down room and hang out with the guys who finished second and third. And there's some awkward banter there.
There's a screen going that shows the best maneuvers on the track that they you scored against one another. So there's also like, well, actually, you know, that move was a little bit too, you know, so it will, you know, you get to relive all of the moments that basically rankled you during the race.
Then you have to go up on the actual podium where they play the national anthem of the driver and the national anthem
of the winning driver
of the, I guess, the home base of the team.
Yes. Yeah.
So we know the...
For the host... no, they play... So before the race, they play the anthem of the host country, and then afterward, they play the anthem of the driver. Of the winning driver.
Okay. Yeah. So last year, we heard the national anthem of the Netherlands 15 times, so I feel like I know it.
Yes.
I know it by heart.
Yeah.
But then... so then you get your trophy... And then they hand you this enormous magnum of champagne, and then you have to playfully spray the other two dudes, two of which probably would just as soon like to hit you over the head with the champagne bottle as spray champagne on you. And
pretty
honestly,
much, yeah.
They do a really good job of pretending like they don't hate each other.
Yeah.
Every time. That's the whole weird orchestrated part of that. It just cracks me up.
Yeah.
And then to Lewis's eternal credit, he even somehow managed to be relatively, like, you know, he lost the championship 2 years ago on the last lap of the last race in controversial fashion to Max. That seemed like the time when Max should have taken a champagne bottle to the head.
On a technical ruling that should never have been made, that got everybody involved with it fired.
Yep.
But Max was allowed to keep his championship, even though the official, let's call it the official tea leaves from the FIA is that a grievous officiating mistake was made that resulted in Max winning the championship.
Right. So you correct me if I get any of this wrong, but basically what happened was in a hard fought championship season, unlike the one we had last year where Max won it with four races to go.
Yeah.
We get down to the end of the final race, and Lewis is going to win. He's got the lead.
Yeah.
And then there's a safety car. That's basically what they call it. Yeah. I don't know what it is
in
NASCAR.
Basically.
It's a pace car. But there's a wreck, and they have to bring the safety car out to drive around, slow down the field, and bunch them back together. They were running out of laps, so the race was going to finish under the safety car.
Yeah.
And they got the wreck cleared, but they didn't get it cleared in time to do what they always do, which is the last thing they do is they instruct the cars that are lapped to get in front of the safety car. Basically, get the fuck out of the way for the real racers for the end of the race.
Yeah.
They didn't do it because they didn't have enough time to get them to the front and still finish while they were racing. So they just left them where they were. And the safety car peeled off. Well, what had happened was Lewis, because he was leading, he didn't pit. Max did.
Yeah.
Max gets out of the pits, and he's still in second place. Now he gets to pull right up behind Lewis, and he's got brand new tires, and Lewis doesn't. And Lewis is like, when he hears they're going to restart the way they're going to do, he's like, I'm fucked, because I can't hold him off on these old tires.
Yeah.
And it's exactly what happened. And on
and
the
prior to that, he had what, like a... He almost had like a minute long lead on him in the like he had a very comfortable cushion on Max prior to that moment. So it looked for all the world that like his team's tire strategy was going to pay off, and that all he had to do was just keep running. That there was no way that Max closed because they were on the similar tire strategy, and he was going to win the race.
At one point, Lewis could have gotten out of the car and pushed the car. And still won.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden he's got a car right up his ass with fresh tires, and he couldn't hold him off, and he got passed, and Max not only won the race, but he won the world championship.
Yeah. And but also to Lewis's immense credit and skill, he fought the guy off for two turns, which is like this guy is just such an incredible driver. I mean, there were moments last year where, you know, their car, Mercedes's design strategy clearly failed them last year. They were very solidly like the third best team on the grid, and yet there would be weekends where, you know, Lewis's car was just like garbage, and he would will it to the front on sheer talent and wind up on the podium, and you're like, how is this guy doing? Like, to me, he's really interesting when he has to like figure out problems like that. And for people to say that, like, oh, he's just good because Mercedes has had like this huge technical, this decade-long technical advantage in the hybrid era, sort of misses just how damn good this guy is in anything you give him.
So one other thing I enjoy about watching the races is it's unbelievable to me the way these races are covered on TV. You know, these tracks are 2.5, 3.5 miles long, and there nothing happens on the track that you don't see. They will find if you don't see it live, they will find an angle of it and they will show you everything that happens. And it's just like playing the F1 video game on PlayStation or Xbox, in that you're in the cockpit all the time. You can see the diagnostics. It's unbelievable just how. And here's the thing that convinced me as I started watching races, I was going to keep watching them, was it ticked all the boxes that I need for my other sports other than baseball, football, and basketball. Is most of the stuff happens in Europe, so the races are first thing in the morning. I'm up.
So great,
there's
right?
nothing else to watch. I'm going to watch that.
Yeah. 9 o'clock to, like, it finish. It's like starts around 9 and it's over just as the NFL pregame shows are logging on.
The races are time limited, so it can't go long. They will start lopping laps off of it. You don't have to worry about that. One of the things that it took me a few races to figure out, I'm not the smartest guy, was that they don't refuel. So they try to put the least amount of fuel possible in the car because they were trying to keep it as light as possible to run those laps.
Yeah,
and
whatever,
there are times when,
if
there's a rain, if there's a weather thing, or there's a number of safety cars, there are times when some of the cars are like, uh-oh, we don't know if we have enough fuel to finish.
Yeah.
And the pit stops are ridiculous. I mean, you know, they pull in now, obviously they're not refueling because they don't have to, but they will change all four tires in like 2.7 seconds.
Yeah.
And after you watch a few races, you can tell when ooh, that went a little long, and it's like 3.2 seconds. You can tell the difference between a 2.7 second and a 3.2. So you know, it's kind of like soccer, where you know how much time you're going to invest today in this. It's not going to run long. You're going to get to see everything. There's all kinds of cool stuff. You're going to get to hear the drivers talk to the people in the pits, and sometimes that stuff is really good and really interesting.
So juicy, yeah.
Especially when Ferrari is involved. And
well, I was going to say, it also has sort of what we've been talking about with the Bears, in that, like, the teams are almost personalities onto themselves, where you know that, like, Ferrari has is by far the most, the richest, most followed, most popular of the teams on the grid. They're the most resourced. Their cars are amazing. And yet their drivers are fantastic. Yep. But you know that they are good for stepping on a rake and like a perfect in a situation that is grooved for them to succeed. So like all of last year was supposed to be a championship race between Max Verstappen and Charles Leclerc, because Red Bull had all season long it seemed like Red Bull's advantage was in cornering speed and Ferrari's advantage was in straight ahead speed, and so they were relatively even on the cards. But strategically, Ferrari would just make boner after boner after boner and sabotage Leclerc, who is a legitimately good driver, but also has a tendency to get into his own head. So now, like, he will compound their errors by because he thinks something bad is going to happen. And all of that just, like, makes it that much easier for Max to just, like, run away with a race. And so you also have, like, if you know, like, for me, you know, last year you sort of, like, I'm a Mercedes guy because of Lewis, and you sort of know that, like, all right, they're not in this race, but, like, at least I can watch and see like how Ferrari is going to mess up a race that they obviously yep. should win. So good. It's so good.
And they, to give them credit, they screwed up in multiple different ways. It's not like they didn't make the same mistake. They invented new mistakes. And last year, their principal was a guy named Matteo Bonato, who looks like an Italian grown up Harry Potter.
Yes. Yeah.
And he's no longer the principal. It is now Fred Vasseur. But they had a race where they had their two drivers, Charles Leclerc and Carlos Sainz, running second and third when there was a safety car. And the traditional thing is you leave one of them on the track with their existing tires to hold position. You send somebody else into the pit. They didn't pit either one of them. And they didn't finish second and third. They finished third and fourth. In Monaco, they're chasing, like, Checo Perez has a lead. It's just clinging to it for dear life. And they pitted both of them at the same time. And now you might think, why is that a problem? The problem is every team only has one pit. You can't have two cars in the same pit. Yeah. And so Carlos goes into pit, and they're yelling, box, box, box. And the guy who's not supposed to not be telling Charles to box, box, box says it. Charles starts to pull in, sees that Carlos is there, just starts swearing because now they're completely screwed. But they just kept doing it. They to the point where for the second half of the season, Carlos was making his own strategic decisions in the car. And one of the things that cracked me up, especially late in the season, is a lot of times these teams will have like multiple strategies planned. I mean, the analytics people have run this.
They would love the sport
1,000 times. They have every variable, and so they'll go in like, okay, we have plan A, B, and C. And there would be times when Ferrari would be they get on the and they it's like they were asking the drivers like, how do you feel about plan Y?
And the
announcer's like, well, how far down on the list are they? What? How is this possible? Yeah, so Ferrari had built a car that was
beautiful car. Yeah.
Was super fast, and I can't remember how many poles Leclerc got. He had the most. It was 8 or 9, I think.
Yeah.
The problem was it was great running the 12 or 13 laps total that you run in the three parts of qualifying, but then it would by lap 15 in the real race it would have shredded its tires. So they were, and they were. That's the thing they screwed up more than anything was their tire strategy.
Yeah.
You have to pit once a race. No matter what. So you have to change tires at least once. But there are some, it's like, was this going to be a one-stop or a two-stop? Some tracks are three stops, and Ferrari would get the tires wrong. That's one of the things they did to Leclerc was they sent him out on...
Why don't you start on hards, even though we have the fastest car here, and then, you know, like, midway through the race, we'll put you on intermediates. It's like, no, we have, and then, like, not touch any of the soft tires that we have until, like, oh, crap, do you want to come in now for soft tires? Like, no, I'm eighth now, and this race for me is over. It's just, like, super boneheaded stuff.
So here's a question I want to ask you about the tires, because when you watch the beginning of the broadcast, they will show you what the three tire selections are for the day. And they vary from track to track, but it's the same like 6 or 7 kinds of tires, right? It's just one track, this might be considered the soft, but on another track, it might be the medium or whatever, the intermediate, whatever they call it.
Yeah.
Okay. That was the thing I was always, the thing about watching it on TV is they do a nice balance of the, you're the hardcore F1 guy who knows all this shit, and I don't need to explain it to you, while explaining just enough of the other stuff so that the guys like me, after a while, could kind of figure it out. And they can very confidently sit there and go, well, I know what they're talking about. I know what that is.
I know
where the DRS zones are on this track.
I think the best thing that ESPN did was concede that Sky Sports probably knows the sport better than they do and just let them... avail their airtime to them to present it to American audiences, because I feel like they could have totally messed it up by trying to, and they have messed it up in the past by staffing it and sort of calling it in the American style of like,
yeah, it's a,
you know, here's, you know, oh, they're going to a, this is like a cover two situation that they're yeah. trying to do with this, you know, with this pit strategy or, you know, like, so the fact that they accept that this is a European sport is great. And what I love about it is that there is none of the reverence on the part of the announcers, that if they see some wacky stuff happening, they'll just call it out. Like, this isn't the, you know, in the same way that, like, you know, Snoop does at celebrity boxing matches. Like, there's no filter as far as, like, what the fuck is Ferrari doing? You know, like, they won't swear, but they'll be like, what the hell is happening? And I think that adds to the fun of it, where you feel like, okay, like, these people on TV aren't lying to me. Yeah. You know, they're not telling me that this great, this race is, like, better or worse than I think it is.
I don't know this, but I feel like when NBC got the Premier League rights and basically just, they didn't try to Americanize it at all. They didn't bring in American yeah. soccer experts. I mean, you get Tim Howard, but that's as close as you get. And he played in the Premier League long enough that it's not like right. they just grabbed yeah. some MLS superstar to do this. And, you know, and you can watch all the matches, so you get used to hearing all the British voices or whatever. And that's just, yeah. that feels like the Premier League. And it's almost like, I know that ESPN did it for, I think that made it like more, easier for them to just take the Sky Sports thing and just rebroadcast it and not have people go, what the hell is this? Why are we watching this?
Yeah.
But I think they also did it because up until this year, they had those rights super cheap. They got yeah, it for yeah, almost yeah. nothing.
Zero, yeah.
When Liberty Media bought F1, basically,
yeah.
their whole thing was, we just got to get these on in America.
And yeah, people just have to see this thing.
They literally, ESPN paid like $1.5 million or some ridiculous thing yeah, a year. Now they're paying like so 50 cheap. Because people are actually yeah. watching it. But yeah, now you couldn't go back. They couldn't switch it now because we're used to seeing yeah, that yeah. coverage. That's what we want. We would riot if they did it the other way. So I'm glad you talked about the announcers, because one of the things that happens almost every race, depending if he's calling it or not, is it's can't miss TV, and the most uncomfortable like 15 minutes of live TV is when Martin Brundle does the walk. He does his race walk.
Love it.
He walks Love up it. The he walks up and down like the main straightaway where all the celebrities yeah. are still like hanging out, and he's just randomly grabbing people and interviewing them.
It's so great.
And
it's
he
so
doesn't great. Know who half of them are, which is just great.
It's so awesome.
The potential for him to say something horrible or to talk to the wrong person is always there. And it played itself out perfectly at the first ever race in Miami when he went up to a very tall, obvious athlete.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he started interviewing Patrick Mahomes. The problem was, it was Paulo Banchero. It was not.
Yeah.
It wasn't yeah. Patrick Mahomes. And it's like, okay, yeah. Martin, I know you're not tall. And I know you think football players are tall. But that dude is 7 feet tall. He's not an NFL quarterback. But that's not even the most like uncomfortable. To me, the most uncomfortable thing is Martin will just kind of desperately start grabbing people when he doesn't have anybody to talk to. But then either in his ear or he'll see somebody, there's somebody better. And he's got to yeah. ditch the person he's interviewing and go talk to them. And sometimes he's pretty good at it. And sometimes he's basically just like, okay, I got to go talk to somebody better. And he just wanders off and goes and talks to them. So I love that. I also always watch the 30-minute wrap-up that Ted Kravitz does that they show on ESPN Plus, where he goes through.
That's great.
He runs through. He walks down the garage as they're putting everything away. They're packing up to go to the next race. And Ted is liable to say anything, too, which is great.
Yeah.
It just makes for
real. Ted said Lewis got robbed. It was hugely controversial. Red Bull wouldn't talk to him for a while after that. But the fact that he's like, if he got jobbed, and I'm going to say it, and it is what it is. It just, again, speaks to the editorial freedom that those guys have. I mean, can you imagine I almost said Joe Buck, and I know that's the wrong guy to imagine, but like, I don't know, what's name a controversy, you know, if like somebody was like, they shouldn't have made that pass interference call in the Super Bowl in the middle, like some sideline reporter said that in the middle of the broadcast, they'd be like, well, good luck getting into the winning locker room, loser. But at F1, it is sort of accepted that, you know, these disagreements will happen. There'll be a frosty period, but then they'll just go right back to business as usual. So,
yeah, and the amount of credibility that it gives you to the audience is worth the F1 teams. They're basically huge marketing organizations on top of race organizations. They can't shut out Sky Sports. They can do it as a show of defiance. It can't last because they need them.
Yeah.
They're not going to do it. So Ted knows. He can say something, and it might be a week or two before he can grab, you know, Christian Horner and talk to him for, you know, 8 minutes, at, you know, in the post-race stuff. But it's not going to last because there's Red Bull to sell.
Yeah, they got to sell energy drink.
Yeah. So it's not going to last. You can say what the hell you want as long as you're right.
Yeah.
So this year, the Red Bull's controversy last year is they had to have another one. Well, actually, two things. One was not a controversy. One was, you know, the great moment in every, you know, racing season is the driver drives across the finish line and he's secured the championship and the announcer goes nuts and then the principal gets on the horn and says, Max Verstappen, you are world champion. And last year it happened in Japan and nobody knew that he won.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, complicated thing about, I guess there was a race that I missed like 2 years ago where they ran like four laps and then it rained too hard. They couldn't finish and they awarded full race points to everybody. So you basically got your points for how you qualified because nobody could pass because nobody could drive around. They came up with a complicated formula based on how many laps you finished. You get this percentage of the points. And so it was raining in Japan, actually to the point where that was where Pierre Gasly almost ran into the, like, there was
tractor,
a wreck and there was a tractor out on the course picking up at Pierre, ignoring the fact that on the replay his dashboard is flashing red and he's still going 180 miles an hour and almost ran into it and then freaked out on the radio. They shortened the race and everybody's doing their little mental calculations like, oh, Max is going to win, but he's going to come up 1 point short, so it's going to be next week in Austin where he's going to win the championship. The interesting thing was the feed that we saw, even though the Sky announcers were talking about how, oh, Max just barely missed it, they put the standings up, they put the points up, and he had enough points. And Crofty, I can't remember his first name.
Yes, David Croft.
David Croft. That doesn't sound right. Yeah, not Seals.
That doesn't sound right either. Sorry.
Anyway, he's really good. But he's kind of like, well, he's don't pay any attention to that.
David Croft, I got it.
Max is being interviewed on the tarmac or whatever they call it, and by
Parc Fermé,
yes. Oh, and I love chicanes. There's European terms that I just love.
Such great, like, what's
so
many great words.
Oh, it's just like a little curve in the road. That's what
curlicue.
So he's getting interviewed by David Coulthard, is that how you say his name? Who then tells him that he won the championship, and Max is like, no, I don't think I did. And he's like, yes, you did. He's like, oh, the most anticlimactic finish to a season ever. And yes, he actually did win it. But coming down to the stretch last year, F1, in an effort to try to level the playing field, because there are three like elite teams. There is Red Bull, Ferrari, and Mercedes.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a big gap. And then there's like the mid-tier teams.
Yeah.
Like McLaren and Alpine. And then there's Williams.
Yes. Williams, toward the back. You've got Aston Martin probably behind Alpine now. And all the way at the back is Haas. So Williams, Haas. I'm forgetting somebody else. And AlphaTauri, which
Red Bull owns and wants to sell.
Red Bull support team, yeah.
Yeah.
And Alfa Romeo, so those two guys.
So they put what they call the spending cap in. And for American sports fans, we know salary caps are bad. Yeah,
that's old hat for
and
us.
And we all want our team to just completely ignore the salary caps. Like, fuck it. Who cares? It's you're a billionaire. Yeah. Spend whatever you want.
Pay the luxury. Steinbrenner it up.
So F1 put this spending cap in, and it sounds like this huge accounting nightmare where you have to put everything into a spreadsheet, and you have to turn in your receipts, and you have to prove what you did this, and you spent this much on the wind tunnel, and you spent this much on this. It even down to the point where they were figuring out that the catering for the crew, that was going to count. So they were trying to figure this stuff out. So everybody turns their stuff in, and two teams went over. Aston Martin went over by a little bit, and nobody cared because they're Aston Martin, and Red Bull went over by more than a little bit. And they were running away with the championship in this brand new era. I don't even know how it works. They give you the basic specs of what the car is, the new car, and then you get to tinker with it. And Red Bull throws out this super dominant car, and then they realize they went over by $6 million.
Yeah.
And so everybody's throwing a fit, and Red Bull's like, "No, we didn't go over it. You're crunching the numbers wrong." Then there was even this ridiculous thing about how, there was a tax credit that they could have applied for, but they filled the forms out wrong, and they didn't get the tax credit. And that would have barely put them on. It's I don't need to hear all this complicated shit. But basically what it turned out was the FIA said, yes, you guys went over. And their penalty was they could have taken points away from them. They could have done all kinds of stuff. And they didn't do any of that. They gave them an $8 million fine, which Mr. Red Bull dug around in the cushions of his couch and found the $8 million and paid it.
Yeah.
And then they gave their other one was they gave them a 10% reduction on the amount of wind tunnel testing that they can do for this season. And that was it. That's all they did.
So dumb. So dumb.
Now, and Red Bull was like, "Oh, but you don't understand. That's a horrible penalty because the way they give you the amount of time you can spend in a wind tunnel is an inverse it's the opposite of the standings. So the champion team already has the least amount of development time in the wind tunnel. And now we're going to lose 10% of that." And some of the other principals are like, "They already built the car. It's going to be the same car until 2026. So all the shit they already did to it, they're that much farther ahead of us right now. And we're not going to be able to catch up to that in 1 year anyway." And so they're doing their testing in Bahrain last week. And surprise, surprise, Red Bull's car, much faster than everybody else's. To the point where the BBC podcast I was listening to, they got to the end and they were going to do their season predictions and they all went, there's no need to do it.
Yeah,
Max is going to win the championship and Red Bull is going to win the Constructors' Championship. It's just all the other stuff. The one thing they did say was they think Mercedes' car somehow was worse than last year, which...
They're either sandbagging or it's worse. Yeah.
The one thing everybody had to do was everybody had to raise the floor of their car by 15 millimeters. But the reason for that was the car last year, one of the advantages Red Bull had was they developed, you correct me when I'm wrong about this stuff,
yeah.
a flexible floor. Where the others had a hard one. And so, if you're Lewis Hamilton and you're Mercedes, they're trying to keep the car as close to the road as possible to give it extra downforce so they can go faster and corner better. And you have this, and your car, as you're driving, they give it an adorable name. They call it porpoising. Because you're going up and down like a dolphin coming out of the water. Except you're trying to drive 180 miles an hour, and it's slamming you into the road over and over and over again to the point where one of the races he could barely get out of the car. They had to help him out of the car because he'd screwed up his back so bad in it. And meanwhile, the Red Bull car is just it's just gently rolling over the thing, going faster than your car. There's a great scene, and I haven't watched the whole thing, but in one of the first episodes of Driver Survive for this year, where they have a principal's meeting. And Toto is basically saying, and I know Mercedes was pushing for them to completely change the rule. They were going to force everybody to raise the height of the car. And he's in his his Teutonic accent. He's screaming and throwing his fit. And Christian Horner is sitting there, and he's like, "Well, fix your fucking car. It's not our problem that you have a shitty car." And Toto's like, "Well, you should fix your fucking car too. Checo says your car is a piece of shit." And what I wanted Christian to go, "Well, how come Max wins every race in it then, if our car is such a piece of shit?" But anyway, yeah. So they had this little spat, and they did change the regular, but only for, they made some change in the second half of the season, a minor one. And this year they they forced them to raise the car a little bit.
They forced everybody to raise up, and it had no material. And so, like, Mercedes had less porpoising. It's really like a Lewis problem with the way that he likes to run his, the raking of the car, I guess, like the angle at which the car sort of raises up from the nose, from nose to tail. And the new regulations suit like the way that Max likes his car to be raked more so than Lewis's, which is why he's trying to like adapt to this, you know, basically to like race in that style. And because of that, his car was bouncing up and down more than everybody else's. But yeah, one detail that you missed about Red Bull's overspending is that not even a quarter of the way through the season, Christian was like, man, I don't know if the salary cap's high enough. Like, we're already pretty much about to hit it now. And Otmar Szafnauer, who is the manager at Aston Martin, was like, not Aston Martin.
He's at Alpine.
Yes, Aston Martin. Alpine now, yes. Was like, no, we all did the math. And, like, yeah. It's enough money.
Yep.
You're just spending more of it. But, yeah, I mean, it is. I used to think the NBA was soap opera for dudes, but it's clearly Formula One. Like, there's so much passive-aggressiveness, aggressive-aggressiveness, petty squabbling, finger-pointing, and Drive to Survive just brings all that out. Yeah. It's great.
Yeah, it's stuff we wouldn't see. There's a whole episode in this season about Otmar, and when you first like hear his name and you think, oh, where's this guy from? Well, he went to Wayne State, and completely unaccented English. He just looks like he looks like a substitute science teacher, just like the most affable, nice guy. There's a whole episode about him about how he went from Alfa Romeo. Basically, he left Alfa Romeo because he got run off by Lance Stroll's dad.
Yeah,
no, Aston Martin, not Alfa Romeo. Aston Martin by Lance Stroll's dad. Yeah. So there's one of the drivers, Lance Stroll, his father. Lawrence has a lot of money and bought into a team and basically said, my kid gets to drive for the team. Now, that's not the first time it's happened. And Lance is actually pretty good. There have been other guys who have gotten F1 seats for no reason. Yeah. Of course, Lance missed testing because he fell off his bike. May or may not have broken his wrist. And so he may be driving on Sunday with his wrist tied to the wheel. That'll be great. Yeah. Anyway, so Otmar went to Alpine, which used to be Renault, which the car was much cooler looking when they were Renault. I like the black and the gold much better than the weird pink that they've got. Yeah, that's a holdover from that Indian team, from like Force of India.
Yeah, Force India.
We can get rid of that. But anyway, so Otmar makes Alpine, there's drastic improvements. They've got one of the best drivers ever, Fernando Alonso, although a guy who I like. I like him a lot.
I like him too. He's cool.
He's a prick to everybody, which is very enjoyable. And about halfway through this episode, he's bragging about his driver lineup. And he's like, we're set. This is great. We've got Fernando Alonso. We've got Esteban Ocon. And then our reserve driver is this kid named Oscar Piastri, who everybody thinks is going to be a champion someday. Hence, they quickly go to a montage of, like, Christian Horner, you know, lamenting that Red Bull could have bought Oscar when he was even younger, and he would be in their stable. Yeah. They let him go, and they're going on and on and on. And then the way they edit it then is, they go on their little summer break. They come back. The first thing you hear from summer break is Sebastian Vettel, who's the driver at Aston Martin, has announced he's retiring. And then you see Otmar chasing Fernando around, basically with a contract, going, don't forget, we need to sign you for your contract's up, and we got to sign you in 2 years. And then the next thing that comes out is Fernando Alonso announcing he's leaving Alpine, and he's going to Aston Martin. And then they're like, okay, fine, we'll just make Oscar Piastri. He'll just be in our lineup next year. So they send out a tweet, and then Oscar tweets, I don't have a contract with them. I'm not going to race with them next year. And, in the middle of this, McLaren dumps Danny Ricciardo, which opens the spot. They swoop in and they sign Oscar Piastri. Otmar threatens to sue them. You're going to sue Oscar for five for the amount of money they put into him to develop him because he went and signed a contract with another team.
Right.
And they knowing McLaren's going to have to pay the money because the poor kid can't pay $5 million. He makes pretty good money as a reserve driver. He doesn't have $5 million to pay.
Doesn't have that.
But anything, it all falls apart around around Otmar in like 30 minutes in this thing.
Yeah.
But then he saved. He pulled it out. He signed my favorite driver, Pierre Gasly. So he'll be now they're a completely French team. Alpine's a French team. Esteban Ocon is a French driver. Pierre is a French driver. Those two guys hate each other and have hated each other since they were little kids, and now they're going to be teammates.
They were both the best drivers in France.
Yeah. So that's
going to and be have fun. Been going for that title their entire lives. Yeah.
But a question that I want to ask you because why is
McLaren... And Gasly's a better driver statistically, but Ocon is the more senior member of that team.
Yeah.
So that's actually going to be, like, super-duper interesting.
Why is McLaren not one of the... Why isn't it a big four? Why is it a big three? Because it feels like they have a shitload of money. They've got good drivers, but they're not. There is a definite gap between the two. And... they have the coolest looking car, I think. They have the best color scheme with the cool orange.
I love
and
that papaya orange. Yeah. Gosh, why does McLaren suck? That's a difficult.
Is it their American boss, Zach Brown?
It is a little bit of a Zach Brown problem, and Zach Brown being an American has been very savvy about being like the coach, the sort of pulling the Danny Ainge like moves of like not Ainge, who's a better the Pat Riley move of like I'm the team president, general manager, coach, but whenever I do either the coach or general manager job poorly, I can just take cover by still being the senior most sports executive, and then just like dump the blame on somebody else who's supposed to be in charge of that, or like whoever is really running that department while I'm figureheading it. So it is interesting that he hasn't gotten a lot of criticism about how underdeveloped the car has been, because he does have a driver who's like really, really good. But throughout that, he's been able to sort of like dump. He's been able to like when their development was really, really bad, when he came on and he scored the big coup of signing Alonso to begin with, and then when he couldn't improve the car fast enough, it was like, well, it's a little bit of the car, but it's, you know. But like Fernando's lost his, lost his edge. So we'll just part ways and it'll be fine. It'll be fine because we'll sign this like awesome cool Australian guy who was winning races with Red Bull, and then like Danny Ric just never really got comfortable behind that car, and to me that is so mystifying because. I felt like Daniel Ricciardo was certainly like good enough to win a championship in Formula One, and thought he, you know, was the senior Red Bull driver when Max was elevated, and I thought, you know, that he would like win for a while, and then like he and Max would be fighting for championships, and that he just totally like they whatever they did to crush his confidence, like he never.
Yeah.
Really recovered from, and even though he had his successes here and there, it just never. I don't know what happened there. But anyway, last year it was like, oh well, you know, Lando Norris is overperforming in the car, so we know he's good. We're going to give him like a giant deal because he's clearly the franchise, and meanwhile, like Danny's really struggling in the car. Oh, it'll get better. No, actually, like, he sucks, so we're going to dump him. So now you've got your two young guns of, like, Norris and Piastri. And so I feel like this year there's going to be a lot of scrutiny on McLaren being like, you know, you have easily two of the best young drivers in this, you know, in racing. Like, why, to your point, like, why is the car's development stagnating? And they might say, well, you know, because of where we've fallen in the Constructors' Championship in years past, like, we just don't have the money to throw at the problem that Mercedes can throw at the problem. Like, we're still sort of overcoming the legacy of the financial setup of the sport, and so it's going to take us a while. You know, we may not have like a car to offer them in 2026 until 2026, which is why we're going with young talent versus, you know, sort of holding older drivers hostage. Yeah. But I do think there is a lot of like sort of NFL style, NBA style, like general managership happening with Zach over there. Yeah.
Yeah. The Daniel Ricciardo thing was really odd. You know, he went from, it made sense when he left Red Bull. He went to Renault. And he left because it was clear.
Like, Max was getting everything.
Right. So Max was going to be the number one driver. And the number two driver's role basically is to support the number one driver and to try to win the race if the number one driver's car crashes.
Yeah. to be the fullback. Checo to be the Perez's blocking fullback.
Is. Yeah, right.
To be the blocking fullback who catches passes occasionally.
Which Checo did in that final race last year. He brought Lewis back into the back closer to Max before all that other crap happened. That basically was his job. So he goes to Renault, and he has success at Renault. He won races at Renault.
Yeah.
And everybody was shocked when he jumped to, I'm sure he went to McLaren, because McLaren threw a huge bag of cash at him. But last year, he was finishing like 17th and 18th. It was like he wasn't even, you know.
While Lando was consistently, you know, 4-5, and if there was drama at the sharp end of the grid, like he was in podium position.
Yeah.
And Danny was just like never there. Like, their pace was like so wild. There's the gaps between their paces is just like, was just wild. Even a qualifying pace, like, you know, Danny would struggle to get into the next session, and Lando would get there comfortably. And I'm just like, what? What is happening with these two guys?
So yeah, that's, to me, it's just a mystery. It seems like that team should be more competitive than they are, and maybe they could save some money if they didn't pay Zach Brown. The quasi American team, for people who feel like they have to have an American team to root for, would be Haas. It's owned by
Italian American, yeah.
Right, but it's owned by Gene Haas, who, if you've ever been in a, and I live in Rockford, Illinois, so there's machine shops everywhere. If you've ever been in one, there's Haas machines in every single one of them. That's what he does.
All those CNC machines, that's all him, yeah.
And their principal, Gunther Steiner, not only talks like a Muppet, it's the weirdest voice ever. Yeah. But he's liable to say anything. It's usually the wrong, most insensitive thing possible at the time. So he's worth the price of admission just for that. They have the unusual, I think, right? They have the unusual circumstance of both of their drivers this year are guys they have fired.
Yeah.
Kevin Magnussen and Nico Hülkenberg are back after both being told, you're not good enough, you're gone. And then it's like, would you please come back? Because we can't pay top driver money, and
which is why they went young and fired them.
Yep.
But then their young guys crapped out, and then I was like, not only did their young guys crap out, but Hülkenberg came in for Nikita Mazepin, who might be my most hated driver ever.
Right, they had to. They basically had to fire a driver because he was Russian, and a Russian. Yeah. Russia invaded Ukraine, and they said,
that's pretty
Nikita,
much how it's
you got to go. Yeah. And then there used to be a race at Sochi, and that race is no more because of that. They're not going to race in Russia. So,
but then Nico got in the same car and wildly overperformed in it, and they were like, wait a minute, maybe this car is better than we thought it was, and perhaps, you know, like our technical savvy would be better served by having actual human sensors who could tell us when we're going in the right direction. Yeah. So, yeah, it's like, so they found a value in, they found a new market in guys who had been fired from F1 and desperately want back.
Right. That's the new market inefficiency is hire guys who've been fired. Yeah, because their second driver last year was supposed to be their first driver last year. Because Kevin Magnussen wasn't supposed to be their number one, but he was.
No.
Was Mick Schumacher, the son of Michael Schumacher, one of the all-time greats. And there is a painful Drive to Survive episode this year.
I heard. Yeah.
Just detailing all of his struggles. And you can literally see his confidence go away. And you could see, you know, he wrecks during, you know, they basically do the push-push thing they tell him during qualifying. And the minute he hits the accelerator, he spins. He completely destroys the car. And then you get to hear Gunther call Gene and beg for $1 million to fix the car. And it's just, yeah, it did not.
And Gunther certainly does his part to chip away at.
Yes, I can't imagine. I can't imagine a worse guy to have with young drivers. Than
yeah,
him.
at the young Schumacher's confidence, who by all accounts is a wonderful guy and legitimately talented.
Yeah,
so.
And he's a reserve driver at Mercedes this year. Danny Ricciardo is a reserve driver for Red Bull, which I'm sure at no point this year if Checo struggles will. Create any drama at all.
Not at all. Yeah.
The fact that he's standing there in the background, you know, waiting to do something.
Again, fire drivers. It's the new market efficiency.
Well,
Danny's got a future.
In the show, Gunther gets asked when he's clear that Mick is not going to make it if they'll get Danny Ricciardo, and he's like, "We're going to want $10 million. We can't afford that." It's like, okay, well, I guess they're not going to get him.
Yeah, that's my agent won't be calling you guys. But you forgot about the most exciting.
I was going to say, there's one more American connection.
Yeah, Logan Sargeant, man, starting with the second Williams driver this year. And from everything I've heard, is really good. And, you know, could be the first American since Michael Andretti to score F1 points. Michael Andretti, son of Mario, who left his successful American open wheel racing career in the mid 90s to race one season in F1 and hated it so much that he got out of there the first opportunity that he could. But
didn't he win Monaco?
No, he didn't win anything.
Oh, he didn't win anything. I thought he won Monaco. Okay, I made that up.
No, I don't think anyone. I don't think anybody's won. Any American, certainly no American has won a championship since Mario. I want to say no Americans won a race since Mario either. But anyway, Logan is really well positioned because Williams is the feeder team for Mercedes. Yeah. And the last few go-rounds, Mercedes has elevated drivers from Williams to be Lewis is number two, and the last driver is George Russell, is a guy they think will be the future number one, because Lewis, you know, maybe has a couple more seasons left in him. So if Logan really performs, you know, overachieves at Williams as drivers can do there, he is a chance to go from the very back of the grid to the very front, racing with George Russell in 2 or 3 years,
George certainly
amazing.
Did it because Williams had fallen on basically out of the base. They're barely competitive.
Yeah,
and he hops in his Mercedes and he outqualified Lewis a handful of times and he outfinished him quite a few times. The doe-eyed George Russell. It looks literally like if you put a racing helmet on Bambi, that's what it would look just like George Russell. It's almost to the point where it's like, are you wearing fake eyelashes, George? I mean,
And he's a sizable guy, you know. Yeah. Like he could be an NBA combo guard. Like he's got some real height to him.
Yep. Yeah, so I guess one of my questions is, with Nicholas Latifi not around, who gets to finish last every race?
Oh man, so, I mean it should be Logan, but I don't want to do that to him. I mean he's going to have a steep learning curve, but gosh, I mean, it's got to be. It's got to be the. I mean, it's for as great as like for as solid as the Haas drivers are. It's, you know, like you can't depend on. I feel like the skill of the drivers is more dependable than the actual technical proficiency of the car. Yeah. Like at some point, the car will let them down. But yeah, I would say between those two guys and the Albon, Alex Albon, Logan Sargeant combination, that's probably the race for the bottom right there. Just because of the cars, nothing personal, guys. I love all of you guys.
Yeah, well, it all starts on Sunday in Bahrain.
Yeah,
there are three American races this year. They have Miami, which they have that weird track actually at Pro Player Stadium with the yachts parked on fake water.
I was there last year. It's so surreal, but it actually totally works.
And then Austin, which has had a race for quite a while. And then the newest one is in Las Vegas, where it's a road course, and part of it goes down the strip. So it's going to look cool, if nothing else.
It's going to look really great, yeah.
And then there's a race in Canada, there's a race in Mexico, and there's a race in Brazil. So those are your Western Hemisphere things that happen at like noon or one. The rest of the stuff it happens, you know, on my perfect schedule. First thing in the morning to watch it, except for like Singapore, which happens in the middle of the night. So I'm like, screw that. Right. I record that one and I just watch it whenever I get up.
Or Melbourne or something like that. Yeah.
But that is the good thing about it. You can pick up this sport as something you want to follow, and it doesn't have to get in the way. You don't have to give up anything else. You don't have to pay less attention to your kids or to the Cubs or whatever. It's F1 is just there for you. All right. Well, I'm glad to have somebody on to confirm some of the things that I thought I knew and to set me straight on some of the things that I didn't.
Yeah, man. No, it's always. I'm always here for you. You know, if you wanna get, if you wanna, whether it's to commiserate about the Bears or
we got it all done today. It was a big therapy
to check in about, the Ferrari's latest melodramas on track. Like, yeah, let's do it.
Oh, and there'll still be some. I know they're like, well, you know. Matteo was an engineer, so he was kind of oddly cast as the principal, and the strategy guys could argue in the background and they could get mass confusion. Fred Fred's a racer. He knows. It's like, no, it's Ferrari.
Nope, it's still going to be weird. It's still going to be an issue. In fact, the engineer was probably the best guy to be in charge because he had the most even temperament. And now we got the race guy who's going to be gambling all over the place and costing them wins. So, yeah. Just make it interesting. That's all I ask. I can't do another season of like Max winning everything.
Yep, because that's basically what happened. And it didn't matter where he started. There was a race he started 11th, and he won.
Yeah.
I mean, there are races on the circuit where if you don't start in the front row, you're almost certainly not going to win. And then there's other.
Right. If you miss the first turn, you're guaranteed to lose.
So they
in
had
Austin.
Him where they took a. So it, if you do, you have X amount of upgrades you can do. And then beyond that, you have to actually pay a penalty. They either drop you X amount of spots or you start at the back. I guess it depends on when you do the upgrade. Sometimes, like if somebody wrecks in qualifying and they're going to have to do massive overhaul to their car overnight to get it ready, they're going to start at the back. They're going to be hanging out with, last year they got to line up next to Nicholas Latifi. And so Red Bull just took a penalty one time and figured, Max will probably finish third or fourth.
Yeah, yeah.
And he won. So, yeah. We don't need another season of that. It's,
The best part of that race was when when Toto Wolff was like, I told my guys to be alert to him. And that he would probably get into the lead by lap 5. And sure enough, he was like one or two laps off. But like that is just how good that car is.
Yeah.
How good they've got that
I thought there was a sign last year of how Mercedes was struggling, that there were a couple of races where Toto just didn't come.
Yeah.
It's like, no, he's taking the week off. It's like, wait a minute, what? There's only 23 races. Or 22 last year, 23 now. And he's like, now I'm going to have to take a couple of weeks off. It's like, all right. So basically, we can finish. We're going to finish fifth and sixth, and they can do that whether I'm in Germany or here at the track. So they can.
Yeah.
Boy, Toto's wife is a
Susie.
Was
yeah,
a
she just
car.
Got a big job.
Yeah.
She's really good. I mean, she should have been. I mean, she's good enough to be driving now. I think. But yeah, they're a fun family. I think there's like a Drive to Survive episode where they race each other, and it's really cute. Or like there's scenes where like she's driving and he's like, slow down.
All right. Well, thank you. I appreciate this. I probably kept you on longer than you planned, but
no, it's all good.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Many of us have herpes.